Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
The Crisis Next Door, a weekly report on the biggest conflicts around the world. With host Jason Brooks.
Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. The breakup of the Soviet Union may be three decades old, but hangovers have remained in several former Soviet republics, including Armenia and Azerbaijan, sparring over the disputed territory of Nagorno-Karabakh, with ethnic Armenians taking full control of the territory following a full-scale war fought from 1992 to 94 when Russia brokered a ceasefire. That ceasefire has been violated consistently over the years, but it exploded recently into all-out fighting with heavy weapons and rising casualties. Joining the Crisis Next Door to fill us in is Joshua Kuchera, the Turkey and Caucasus editor at Eurasia.net. Joshua, thank you for joining the Crisis Next Door.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Joshua, what sparked this latest round of fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh between Armenia and Azerbaijan?
Well, it's a bit hard to say what sparked it exactly. We've been kind of leading up to this moment for a long time, and there's been a long expectation that there would be some kind of big offensive, but I don't think there's any one event that that precipitated this. But the kind of the big story is that Azerbaijan has been looking to retake these territories that it lost during that original war in the early 1990s. It lost those territories to Armenia. Since then, it has been trying to get them back, either by diplomatic methods or, failing that, by military methods. For a variety of reasons, they've been losing faith in the diplomatic option, and we can get into that later. And so it seems like this is their first really big attempt to try to change things militarily.
And there have been numerous incidents over the years, skirmishing and sniping. How different is this round of fighting compared to the so-called four-day war in April of 2016?
Well, so yeah, that four-day war in April 2016, that was the biggest, the most serious fighting to date. This seems to have surpassed it already. The main difference here is that in all the previous fighting, including that 2016 war, the objectives seemed fairly modest. Azerbaijan took some small amount of territory that it could then show to the population as a victory, like we're making progress. Or even if it didn't, you know, in some of the more minor cases, it may not have even captured any territory, but it caught the world's attention for a little bit. And they would do this to call attention to the fact that the diplomatic negotiations had stalled. On the two sides, there's a kind of disbalance on the interest in the conflict here, because Armenia basically benefits from the status quo. And so it suits them for really nothing to happen. And so occasionally Azerbaijan will try to kind of shake things up by starting some fighting. That's been the case in the past. What's happening now appears to be a more ambitious attempt to capture some serious territory. I think they've done this game enough times of, capturing a small strategic hill or something that's not going to kind of play with the population anymore. So they need something bigger. And that's what this appears to be.
I have seen some reports that Azeri forces have recaptured some land that they had lost in that 92 to 94 war. How important is that right now in the fighting, and how would you expect Armenia to respond to that?
Well, it's very hard to tell what's going on the battlefield right now. There's massive amounts of misinformation, there's really nobody, I think, outside probably, you know, the intelligence of the two countries who really knows what's going on. There are claims and counterclaims about territories being taken and retaken. But it does seem like Azerbaijan has the objective, and Azerbaijani analysts say that there's a couple of particular districts that were among the ones that Armenia captured in the 90s that Azerbaijan is trying to take back. But as of now, and Armenia is, of course, resisting that. These are largely unpopulated districts, though the fighting is all kind of along the front lines, but it does seem to be concentrated in this area that is particularly unpopulated.
Have seen that some villages have been shelled in the fighting. Has there been much impact on civilians? Any casualties? Any humanitarian issues at this point in time?
There have been, on both sides, civilians killed and injured, and civilian villages hit. It does seem like on both sides those are accidental and kind of one-off attacks, and that the main focus does seem to be so far on military attacks. But there have been a few stray missiles and shells and so on that have landed in civilian areas on both sides.
Quite a bit of heavy weaponry being deployed on the battlefield, artillery, rocket launchers, tanks, and also a lot of videos of Azeri drones being used, and some from Armenia's side showing Azeri drones being shot down. How big of a role are those drones playing on the battlefield?
Again, you know, I hesitate to put a lot of credence into the reports that you hear about drones being shot down or making strikes and so on. And the last round of fairly serious fighting was in July. And there were a lot of excited reports about drones being shot down on one side or the other that later turned out to be false. The video turned out to be from some previous fighting or from some area that's not even in the Caucasus. So I look at those reports with a lot of skepticism, and we'll find out later. Nevertheless, it is true that drones do play a big role, especially Azerbaijan has invested a lot in pretty sophisticated Israeli drones that they use quite heavily. So the drones are a big part of the battlefield, but it's hard to say what their specific impact is so far in this conflict.
Joshua, the conflict is once again bringing Russia and Turkey face to face over a contested area on top of opposing each other. It's Syria and Libya. Russia backing Yerevan and Turkey behind Baku. There have been reports that Turkey is sending fighters from Syria to help Azerbaijan forces, which have been that's been denied by Istanbul and Baku. Have you seen anything to back up those claims? And if there was any truth to that, how destabilizing would that be?
At this point, I think the preponderance of evidence suggests that yes, Turkey has sent these mercenaries from Syria into Azerbaijan. It's a pretty explosive issue, and I think we're only now kind of coming to terms with what this might mean. It's a very strange decision because it's from Azerbaijan's perspective, because I don't really understand what operational value they're going to gain from having these mercenaries. You know, Azerbaijan has its own military. I don't know why exactly they need to have mercenaries at this point. And it does seem that the reputational and moral damage is going to be far greater than whatever operational advantage they will get on the battlefield as a result of them. So frankly, I don't know what they're thinking, and that's going to be my task tomorrow, is trying to work on a story on exactly that question. But it does seem like those reports are true. But to take a step back, you know, I always emphasize that we shouldn't make too much of the international aspect of this conflict. This is very much this is not a proxy war. This is a very locally driven conflict that is rooted specifically in Armenian and Azerbaijani interests. That said, it's always carried the risk of spilling into a proxy war. And this moment is probably the most dangerous moment there's been in terms of it spilling into a proxy war, specifically because of the increased involvement of Turkey. Turkey has always backed Baku, as you said, but that backing has been a little bit shallow and a little bit rhetorical, and it's not really amounted to very much. This time, the rhetorical backing is quite significant. That's obvious. The military backing is not as clear exactly yet. It's a little bit hard to tell. There's a lot of allegations from the Armenian side that have not been proven. This is one allegation that does about the mercenaries brought in from Syria. One allegation that does seem to have been borne out. And the implications for Russia. Russia has, they do back Armenia, but they also have good relations with Azerbaijan. Both countries' weapons are supplied almost entirely by Russia. And so while at the same time, though, Russia does have this mutual defense agreement with Armenia, a sort of NATO-like security treaty that if Armenia is threatened, that Russia is obliged to protect them. So, yes, there is a pretty, you know, I would say it's a small risk, but a really, really, you know, terrible, that the consequences would be really terrible, that this could bring Turkey and Russia into yet another area of conflict.
Does Turkish involvement raise alarm bells in Armenia, given the historical enmity between those countries?
Of course. Naturally. I mean, your readers or your listeners are probably aware of the Armenian genocide committed by the Ottoman Empire in 1915. And that has a massive historical resonance. And it's on the minds of every single Armenian in this conflict, which is another reason why it's really inexplicable that Azerbaijan has done this, because it's only going to make people think that, you know, this is another reprise of the genocide. So it's from a international PR perspective, it's a disaster. And for Armenians, it raises, you know, obviously really natural fears that you know, this something like this could happen again.
You're listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks, and we're talking about the sudden surge in fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh between Armenia and Azerbaijan. And we're talking with Joshua Kuchera, the Turkey and Caucasus editor at Eurasia.net. Iran is another factor as it backs Armenia and borders Azerbaijan. And considering Tehran's alliance with Moscow in Syria, do you think Iran could play a role in the conflict?
Well, Iran is a little bit like, it has much a much smaller degree of ties with the two countries than Russia does. But it's a bit like Russia in that it tries to have good relations with both. It doesn't really back Armenia per se. It has a little bit friendlier relations with Armenia, but it basically tries to stay out of the conflict and more or less plays a neutral role in the conflict. Almost, and actually quite an insignificant role given what a big country it is and that it borders both of the countries. But it seems to think that this is not really its territory. Both, you know, it seems to sort of respect Russia's desire that this be that the Kremlin's sphere of influence, and it sort of just doesn't want to antagonize Russia and tries to stay out of it. So and in this particular conflict, there's been, again, very little Iranian involvement, and I would expect that to continue to be the case.
Joshua, how would you describe the reaction of media in both countries to the fighting?
I mean, it's, of course, extremely patriotic and jingoistic, and people are in Azerbaijan. There's a huge amount of enthusiasm for potentially regaining these territories that they've lost. I mean, Azerbaijanis see this as a great injustice that was done to them in the 1990s. And not to mention that there are 600,000 people who were displaced from their homes during that conflict. From Armenia, there is a great deal of fear. And as you said, with that, the Turkish involvement has only multiplied that fear, that this is a sort of existential battle for them, bringing up these sort of historical bad memories. And so there's both sides have see this as really, really, I mean, it's impossible to overstate the seriousness with which people take this in both countries.
It certainly seems right now that based off of that the populations of both countries are each rallying around the flag. That doesn't seem to bode too well for a peaceful resolution anytime soon, does it?
No, not at all. And you know, this is just continuing a pattern of the last several years where the even in the absence of fighting, there's been a notable lessening of the interest on either side to come to a peace deal. This kind of fighting is only going to make that even more difficult when it was already extremely difficult. So, yes, I think it's very hard at this point to imagine a peace deal.
The Armenians call the area Artsakh, and I apologize if I did not pronounce that correctly. What is the significance of that?
Well, I'm going to get a little bit out of my lane here. To be honest, I don't know. I mean, it's an Armenian word. I believe it's an ancient Armenian term for that region. The interesting thing about Nagorno-Karabakh, it's actually, Nagorno is a Russian word, Kara is a Turkic word, and Bakh is a Persian word. It altogether means mountainous black garden, but none of those words are Armenian. And so Armenians have, in the last few years, revived this old name, Artsakh, for the region.
And of course, being in the Caucasus, it's very difficult terrain. And how key of a role is that terrain in the fighting?
Yeah, I mean, you see the fighting. So part of the front lines are along this fairly flat territory. Part of it is along really very high mountains. So you have the kind of the whole gamut. And it does appear that the specific targets for the Azerbaijani operation in this case are the flatter grounds, which will be easier to take. But should Azerbaijan get more ambitious, either in this operation or in the future, you're right that there's very mountainous terrain that will very much complicate any further offensives.
Joshua, is there anything on the diplomatic front that would suggest a peaceful resolution and future for the region?
No, and not to be, you know, overly pessimistic, but it's at this point, you know, we're at this point, it's very, very hard to see any optimistic outlook. And in terms of the sort of international diplomatic action, there's really been very little. I mean, I don't know if it's that the world is too busy with other things or if everyone has given up on this conflict, but there's really been a noticeable disengagement. People have talked about the U.S. disengagement. The U.S. has been not super engaged in this conflict ever, really. It was more in the 90s and the 2000s, but as the years have gone on, it's sort of stopped playing much of a role. Russia is quite a bit more involved traditionally, and even more recently, Russian diplomacy has been quite active. They're being very quiet as well. And, you know, the UN Security Council did have a meeting yesterday on it, but it seemed to be fairly inconsequential. They just called on all sides to, you know, go back to the negotiating table, and it was a pretty pro forma statement. And so, yeah, there does seem to be a big diplomatic vacuum, which is certainly not helping the issue. That said, I don't think that I think one of the reasons that diplomats have sort of given up on this issue is because it wasn't working. And there's, you know, this is such an existential issue for both countries that there wasn't too much that the international community could do to force them to, you know, come to the concessions, the mutual concessions that they would need to reach a peace deal. So while it's true that there is a diplomatic vacuum, it's also true that it's not clear even that active diplomacy would really accomplish much.
It'll be interesting to see where Moscow goes with this. It seems like Putin has been willing to accept a certain amount of instability on the periphery of Russia, whether it's in Ukraine or in Georgia or even in possibly Belarus right now. And now there's this latest conflict that's going on. And I wonder if Putin will view this differently than he has those other conflicts and where Russia will force the narrative in the coming days and weeks and months.
Well, for sure, because, I mean, there's a huge difference in that in Ukraine and Georgia, Russia, you know, in a large degree instigated that tension. Here they didn't. And here Russia's calculations are a lot more tricky. I think that they don't want a big war on their southern border, certainly. But the status quo tension does suit them because it keeps both Armenia and Azerbaijan somewhat dependent on Russia. Whereas if they managed to resolve the conflict, they wouldn't rely as much on Russia. But then the Turkey factor is quite a wild card in this one because, you know, Russia, like I mentioned earlier, really sees this area as its strategic backyard. And if Turkey rolls in and starts to change the situation, then Russia will see that, if nothing else, as a kind of threat to its hegemony in the region. And, you know, what they would do about that, it's very hard to predict. But I think that's the kind of things they're thinking about in the Kremlin now.
This is going to be a very tough knot to untangle, but we could certainly hope for calmer times ahead in the Caucasus. Yeah. Joshua, thank you very much for joining us here on The Crisis Next Door.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
We've been joined by Joshua Kuchera, the Turkey and Caucasus editor at Eurasia.net. Thanks for listening to The Crisis Next Door. I'm Jason Brooks. Till next time.
The Crisis Next Door with host Jason Brooks is produced weekly.
If you have any thoughts for Jason, email him at tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com. Again, that's tcndpodcast@kcbsradio.com.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.